This is Lesson 13 of Isaiah Part 1. Our focus today will be on chapters 33 through 35. 2 weeks ago, we began the segment that consists of chapters 28 through 33. These chapters describe the destruction of Israel, the northern kingdom, and the folly of Judah, the southern kingdom, in failing to learn from God's judgment of the northern kingdom. Interspersed throughout these chapters, however, are glimpses of the future restoration of the whole of Israel in the millennial kingdom. We also learned in the last 2 weeks that in this segment of chapters 28 through 33, there are six woes, which are an indication of judgment and punishment. This word, woe, expresses an abhorrence of evil, but it is also an expression of grief or a lament over sin. We have covered the first five of the six woes so far. So before we get to the sixth, let's review the first five. The first woe began in chapter 28, verse 1, with a description of Israel, or Ephraim, the northern kingdom, as a fading flower of glorious beauty. It would be trodden underfoot by Assyria, which would unknowingly be acting as the agent of the Lord. The remainder of the first woe was against Judah, whose leaders were arrogant and ignorant of the ways of the Lord. Instead of listening to Isaiah's message to return to the Lord and to rely upon him alone, they chose to take refuge in lies and to attempt to form an alliance with Egypt. Isaiah described this as a covenant with death, a pact with Sheol. In the end times, Israel will again allow itself to be deceived, and it will make another covenant with death, a pact with Sheol, when it signs the covenant with the Antichrist. Their deception will last until it is too late, and then verse 19 of chapter 28 says, it will be sheer terror to understand what it means. The second woe began at chapter 29 and was addressed to Ariel, which is the city of Jerusalem. The word Ariel referred to the bronze altar of sacrifice in the temple courtyard. The whole city would become an extension of the altar, and the whole city would burn on that altar as the Lord entered into judgment against it. The reason for the judgment was set out explicitly in verse 13. The people would draw near to the Lord with their words, and they would honor him with their lip service, but their hearts were far removed from the Lord, and their reverence for him consisted of tradition learned by rote. In other words, they engaged in the traditional ritual observances, but they had no relationship of trust and obedience with the Lord. The third woe began at verse 15 of chapter 29. This was addressed to the leaders of Judah who attempted to hide their plans from the Lord, deceiving themselves into actually believing that the Lord didn't see or know what they were doing. The sovereignty of the Lord was not diminished, however, by this exalted opinion that the men, created beings, had of themselves. And the Lord announced through Isaiah that there would be a great reversal. In that future day, the time of the restoration, the moral change in Israel would be as great as if the woods of Lebanon were to become a fertile field and vice versa. This is a description of the reversal of the conditions of the proud, represented by the forest, and the humble, represented by the field. The fourth woe begins at chapter 30, verse 1. The subject is still the Lord's rebuke of Judah for its attempt to negotiate an alliance with Egypt. Again, there are the backroom, underhanded, secret political deals that the people think the Lord does not see. Not only did the leaders of Judah execute a plan, but they acted without divine direction. Adding sin to sin, they also sought their security from a source other than the Lord. They made an alliance but it was not of the Spirit of the Lord. Since the men of Judah chose to flee on horses, the Lord would invoke lex talionis, the law of retaliation equivalent to the offense. If they wanted to flee on horses, the Lord would cause them to have to flee from a swift enemy. If they were so afraid of Assyria that they could not trust in the Lord, then he would cause them to flee at the threat of one man or at the threat of at most five men. The fifth woe begins at chapter 31, verse 1. The men of Judah chose to place their trust in an ally they could see, created man with horses of flesh, even though their chosen ally, Egypt, was their former place of enslavement, and even though Egypt had no intention of keeping any promises it made. Judah chose to trust Egypt instead of the Lord, who is Spirit, who is the creator of the men and the horses, and who is the only one who is wisdom, and who does not retract his words. Unlike unreliable Egypt, what he promises, he keeps. Let's summarize the first five woes. In chapter 28, only the first four verses were against Israel, the northern kingdom. The remainder of the chapter was against Judah's leaders for refusing to listen to Isaiah and for attempting an alliance with Egypt. The second woe, beginning at chapter 29, verse 1, was against the people of Ariel, which was another name for Jerusalem, for their empty, external, meaningless ritual observances. The third woe, beginning at chapter 29, verse 15, was against Judah's leaders who hid their plans from the Lord, exalting themselves above God. The fourth woe began at chapter 30, verse 1, and was against Judah's rebellious leaders who made plans apart from the Lord to rely upon Egypt when they were threatened by Assyria. And the fifth woe began in chapter 31, verse 1. This was also against Judah's leaders who thought their wisdom was greater than that of the Lord, and they chose to rely upon Egypt instead of upon the Lord. Unlike all the prior woes, the sixth and last in this series is not against Judah or even Israel, but against the destroyer. In Isaiah's time, that would have been Assyria. But as is common throughout the book of Isaiah, there are end times prophecies here as well. Be advised, however, that some commentators believe that based on the fact that the prior five woes were against Judah, except for the first four verses of chapter 28, this one must therefore be as well. If you take that point of view, then this woe would be referring to those in Judah who were trying to get help from Egypt. In that case, the one against whom they would have been treacherous would be the Lord himself. My personal opinion is that the destroyer refers to Assyria. The verse describes the leader of this country as one who is treacherous, while others did not deal treacherously with him. This would be a description of Sennacherib, who accepted a large tribute that Hezekiah sent so that he would not besiege Jerusalem. Sennacherib accepted the money, but then he attacked Jerusalem anyway. This is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 13 through 17. In the remainder of this verse 1, Isaiah foretold that Sennacherib himself would be destroyed. As soon as he ceased to deal treacherously, others would deal treacherously with him. What happened is that after the Lord sent his destroying angel, who slew 185,000 of the Assyrian troops, Sennacherib fled back to Assyria, and shortly thereafter, he was murdered by two of his own sons. There is one other contrast between chapter 33 and the earlier chapters, besides the fact that this one is not against Judah. The other contrast is that, particularly in chapter 32, Judah's problems with Assyria were still in the future. But here in chapter 33, Judah was in the midst of those troubles. By now, we have become accustomed to Isaiah's manner of moving around in time in the course of individual chapters. One verse may be speaking of Isaiah's time, but then the next verse may jump ahead to the time of the restoration in the millennial kingdom. And then a few verses after that, it might go back to a description of the day of the Lord. And then the very next verse might revert back to Isaiah's time. This chapter 33 was all over the place, so much so that I felt it was necessary to set out the individual subjects and, insofar as it was possible, the time frames at the beginning instead of at the end of this study of the chapter. We have already looked at verse 1. This set out the woe to the destroyer. In verse 2, the subject changes to a prayer by the faithful in Judah for salvation by the Lord in their time of distress. Verses 3 and 4 and 10 through 12 describe the Lord rising up to scatter the nations as he defends his people. Verses 5 and 6 describe the millennial kingdom when justice and righteousness prevail. We have become accustomed to seeing those twin characteristics, justice and righteousness, listed almost every time there's a description of the millennial kingdom. Verses 7 through 9 describe Judah's time of distress. Verses 13 and 14 contain the Lord's announcement to those who are both near and far that it is time for them to acknowledge his power and might, and the godless in Zion are terrified. And verses 15 through 24 describe the millennial kingdom. As we work our way through this chapter 33, you may wish to refer back to this little outline. We have already looked at verse 1, so let's move on to verse 2, which is the prayer of the faithful in Judah. The text says, O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their strength every morning, our salvation also in the time of distress. Notice that the faithfulness of these people is characterized by their waiting upon the Lord. Of course, this doesn't mean that they are sitting around doing nothing. It means that they are continuing to go about their daily lives, walking in the knowledge of the presence of the Lord and encouraging one another as they wait for their salvation. We have seen this several times before in chapter 25, verse 9, chapter 26, verses 7 through 9, and in chapter 30, verse 18. In verse 3, the faithful people anticipate the Lord rising up to defend them. At the sound of the tumult, peoples flee. At the lifting up of yourself, nations disperse. What this is saying is that the battle is over almost as soon as the Lord arises. And then verse 4 describes the men of Jerusalem going after the spoils as quickly and as voraciously as caterpillars and locusts. Verses 5 and 6 describe the millennial kingdom. The Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. There are those two characteristics that result in peace. Verse 6 continues, And he shall be the stability of your times, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. The picture on this slide shows the outside walls and the pearl gate of the New Jerusalem. The wall of the city had 12 foundation stones. But we already know from Isaiah chapter 28, verse 16, that the costly cornerstone for the foundation in Zion is Christ. And just as this verse 6 of chapter 33 states, He, the Lord, will be the source, with a capital S, of stability. Verses 7 through 9 describe Judah's time of distress. Behold, their brave men cry in the streets. The ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. The picture in this slide was taken when the Nazis invaded France. The Frenchman is weeping over the loss of his nation and national identity. In the case of Jerusalem, the Assyrians did not ever manage to get past the walls of the city, but by this time they had already destroyed much of Judah. The reference to the ambassadors of peace probably refers to the men that Hezekiah had sent earlier with the tribute to Sennacherib. They wept bitterly because their trust in human alliances had proven to be misplaced. Verse 8 indicates that the highways were desolate and the travelers had ceased. Undoubtedly, this was the result of the siege around the city by the Assyrians. The verse goes on to say that He has broken the covenant. He has despised the cities, and He has no regard for man. The near fulfillment of this He would have been Sennacherib, who took the tribute which Hezekiah had paid and then invaded anyway. In the end times fulfillment, the pronoun He will refer to the treacherous Antichrist. Verse 9 says, The land mourns and pines away. Lebanon is shamed and withers. Sharon is like a desert plain, and Bashan and Carmel lose their foliage. This map is in the appendix of your workbook on page 291. Here are the locations listed. The point here is that these places were places of abundant fertility. Assyria had destroyed the most fruitful parts of the land. Verses 10 through 12 return to the same subject as verses 3 and 4, that is, that the Lord rises up to judge the nations. Verse 10 begins with the word now. Now that His people had been punished in measured terms, as described in the preceding verses, now the Lord would exalt Himself by delivering them. As we saw in chapter 27, verses 7 through 9, the Lord's punishment of the enemies of Israel will not be measured. There will be complete destruction. My breath will consume you like a fire, and the peoples will be burned to lime, like cut thorns which are burned in the fire. And then in verse 13, the Lord announces to those both near and far, You who are far away, hear what I have done, and you who are near, acknowledge my might. The godless sinners in Zion are doing just that. They are acknowledging, because they have no choice, the might and power of the Lord. They ask, Who among us can live with a consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? Their questions are answered immediately in verses 15 and 16, which describe the righteous, who are the only ones who may dwell in the millennial Zion. Verse 15 says that the righteous is one who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity. He who rejects unjust gain and shakes his hands so that they hold no bribe. He who stops his ears from hearing about bloodshed and shuts his eyes from looking upon evil. He will dwell on the heights. His refuge will be the impregnable rock. His bread will be given him. His water will be sure. Although these cross-references were not in the homework, this passage, which asks the question at the end of verse 14 and then answers it in verses 15 and 16, reminded me of Psalms chapter 15, which is only 5 verses long. It begins with the question, O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? And then the remaining 4 verses of that chapter describe the righteous man of integrity. There is a similar passage in Psalms chapter 24, verses 3 through 6, which begins with a similar question. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, and who may stand in his holy place? And the answer is in verses 4 and 5. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to falsehood, and has not sworn deceitfully. He shall receive a blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Returning to Isaiah, there is a contrast between what the righteous will see and what they will not see. Verses 17 and 20 describe what they will see. Verse 17 is on this slide. Your eyes will see the king in his beauty. They will behold a far distant land. Verse 20 also describes what the righteous will see. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which shall not be folded. Its stakes shall never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. In between verses 17 and 20, verses 18 and 19 describe what the righteous will no longer see. Verse 18 describes the fear of foreign invaders who taxed and took the property of the people of Judah. Verse 19 describes them as a fierce people of unintelligible speech which no one understood. The righteous in Zion might remember their prior terror, but they would never see or experience it again. Verse 21 says that in Zion, the majestic one, the Lord, will be for us. What a beautiful prepositional phrase, for us. The rest of the verse describes long rivers and moats that represented keeping the enemy at a distance, thus protection from an enemy. And then verse 22 describes this majestic one, the Lord, who will be for us. He will be our judge, our lawgiver, our king, and our savior. Did you notice how all three branches of government were covered in this description? The judge represents the judicial branch. The lawgiver represents the legislative branch. And the king represents the executive branch. In addition, and most importantly, he will save us. He will deliver us from all evil. In verse 23, the enemy is pictured as a disabled ship with a broken mast that can no longer support the sails. Then the spoils of the enemy will be divided, and even the weak and the lame will participate in the plunder. The meek and the gentle shall inherit the earth. The last verse of chapter 33 is full of promise. And no resident will say, I am sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. Again, although this was not in the homework, I was reminded of another cross-reference, this time in Psalms chapter 103, verses 2 and 3, which contain the same two promises. These verses say, Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget none of his benefits, who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases. Both physical sickness and spiritual sin will be no more. Regarding the latter, Hebrews chapter 10, verses 17 and 18 promise, Their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. Now where there is forgiveness of these things, there is no longer any offering for sin. Since we already did the breakdown of the various verses within chapter 33, the overall title I chose for the chapter was The Contrast Between the Righteous and the Wicked When the Lord is Exalted in Zion. Chapter 34 opens with the command, Draw near, O nations, to hear, and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. You may have noticed the similarity between this opening verse of chapter 34 and verse 2 of chapter 1, which says something very similar. Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. At the beginning of the book of Isaiah, all of the created order, heavens and earth, are called to listen and to hear. The difference in the command here in chapter 34, verse 1, is that this time it is the inhabitants of the earth, the nations and the peoples, who are called to hear and to listen. What is it that all the inhabitants of the earth are called to hear and to listen? It is the Lord's sentence of judgment on the whole earth. Why? The answer is provided in verse 2 and again in verses 5 through 7. Let's look at verse 2 first. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. Verse 3 continues, so their slain will be thrown out and their corpses will give off their stench. And the mountains will be drenched with their blood and all the host of heaven will wear away. And the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine or as one withers from the fig tree. These verses sound a lot like Revelation. The description of the massive slaughter matches that of Revelation chapter 19, verses 17 and 18. But the sky rolling up like a scroll parallels Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 14, as well as in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10. Clearly, this is a description of the wrath of God in the day of the Lord. Returning to Isaiah chapter 34, verse 5 says, for my sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. Why Edom in particular? We know that Edom ceased to exist as a nation long ago, but since this is plainly a description of the end times judgment of the day of the Lord, Edom must be a representative of something. The logical conclusion based on our study of Isaiah so far is that Edom must represent nations which are opposed to Israel. But let's review some biblical history to justify and to support that conclusion. Historically, Edom was a neighbor of Israel that was never on neighborly terms with Israel. This map shows its location southwest of the Dead Sea, south of Moab. The Bible tells us of the origin of the people of Edom, the Edomites. Abraham had two sons. The first was Ishmael by Sarah's servant Hagar. Later, his second son, Isaac, was born of Sarah, Abraham's wife. When Isaac was grown and married, his wife, Rebekah, bore twin sons, Esau, the firstborn, and Jacob. Ishmael, Abraham's elder son, married and had a daughter named Mahalath. Esau, Isaac's son, took Mahalath, Ishmael's daughter, as a wife, along with several Canaanite women. The Edomites are descended from Esau and in part from Ishmael through his daughter. While Ishmael, the son of Abraham by Sarah's servant Hagar, was the elder son, he was not the son of the promise. The Messiah would not come from his line. The word Edom means red. The name Esau must also mean red because Genesis chapter 25, verse 25 says that when Esau was born, he came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Although he was the firstborn of the twins, he sold his birthright for a bowl of red stuff. Genesis chapter 25, verse 30 records that Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. Many generations later, after Jacob's son Joseph had first gone to Egypt and then eventually brought the entire family there, where the Israelites grew to a great number and then were enslaved by the Egyptians for approximately 400 years, Moses was leading the Israelites out of Egypt in the Exodus. When they came to the border of the territory of the Edomites, the book of Numbers, chapter 20, records that they sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, "Thus your brother Israel has said," and then they set out their history. The point to notice is that they called themselves the brothers of the Edomites because of their common familial ancestry. They asked the king of Edom for permission to pass through their land. They would not go through fields or vineyards, would not even drink water from the wells in Edom. They would stay on the roads and would pass directly through. But the king of Edom said, "You shall not pass through." And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. That's verse 20. Verse 21 continues, "Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him." Even before Israel was a nation in her own land, Edom treated her rudely. In the homework, we were asked to look at the timeline and find the prophets Obadiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. First, let's locate Isaiah. Here he is on the timeline approximately 700 years before Christ as a prophet to Judah. Obadiah was also a prophet to Judah, but he lived and ministered approximately 100 years before Isaiah. Jeremiah and Ezekiel lived and ministered 50 to 100 years after Isaiah. But all four prophesied to Judah, and all four of them told of what was to happen to Edom because of their violence to their brother Jacob. In addition to the prophets, Psalms chapter 137 tells about the day of Jerusalem when the sons of Edom called for it to be razed to its very foundation. This is hardly brotherly conduct. Ezekiel chapter 35 is a prophecy against Mount Seir, which refers to Edom. "Thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, Mount Seir, and I will stretch out my hand against you, and I will make you a desolation and a waste." Why? The answer is in verse 5. "Because you have had everlasting enmity and have delivered the sons of Israel to the power of the sword at the time of their calamity, at the time of the punishment of the end." Now, this might be a reference to the time of the Babylonian captivity, but it also clearly refers to the time of the punishment of the end, the time of Israel's final punishment. Although Edom no longer exists as a country, the descendants of Esau and of Ishmael through his daughter still covet the land that the Lord gave to Israel, and they still hate the people of Israel. Obadiah spoke of a time when Jerusalem was suffering. It may have been describing the future time of the Babylonian captivity, or perhaps it was describing some other time when Jerusalem was under siege. Nevertheless, in that time, instead of helping their suffering brothers, they did just the opposite. Obadiah wrote in verse 11, "On that day you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them." Indeed, the Edomites went further than just gloating over the distress and misfortune of the Israelites. According to Obadiah, verse 14, they stood at the fork of the road to cut down the fugitives and to imprison the survivors. But the Lord assured them in Obadiah verse 15 that, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head, and there would be no survivor of the house of Esau. Returning to Isaiah chapter 34, verses 6 and 7 present the image of sacrifice. Sin is a matter of life and death. Sin must be atoned for with sacrificial blood. Those who repudiate the sacrifice of Christ for their sins will forfeit their own lives as sacrifices to God. Many different animals are named in these two verses. Lambs, goats, rams, even wild oxen, which are never mentioned in the Old Testament as animals for sacrifice, and young bulls. This is a sacrifice greater than any that has ever been offered. But since this is a picture of the final wrath of God, this gives us an idea of the depth of the heinous character of sin. We have altogether too light a conception of sin, and we really do not appreciate how deeply our sin offends the holiness of God. Because this is a picture of the final wrath of God, however, it is also possible that the description of the vast slaughter may really refer to the blood of the unrepentant and rebellious people of the world who are represented by the Edomites. Lest we should be lulled into thinking that the judgment of the Lord is so far off that we really need not concern ourselves with it, verse 8 assures us that the Lord has a day marked on his calendar when his day of vengeance, his year of recompense for the cause of Zion, will begin. And that date will probably come sooner than we think. That day sounds like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 9 says, "And its streams shall be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land shall become burning pitch." Verse 10 continues, "It shall not be quenched night or day, its smoke shall go up forever." This sounds eerily like passages in Revelation chapters 14 and 19. As we saw before in Isaiah chapter 28, verse 17, in which the Lord said that he would make justice the measuring line and righteousness the level, here at the end of verse 11 of chapter 34, Isaiah says that the Lord will stretch over the land of Edom the line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. The Lord has a standard, a plumb line, against which he measures men. As he said through Obadiah, "As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head." As they had destroyed others to the point of desolation and emptiness, the Lord would do the same to them, and there would be no survivor of the house of Esau. The land of Edom would be desolate forever. Verse 13 says, "Thorns shall come up in its fortified towers, nettles and thistles in its fortified cities. It shall also be a haunt of jackals and an abode of ostriches." Listeners could confirm Isaiah's words by referring to the written record of the prophecy elsewhere. But the word was certain, because the mouth of the Lord had commanded it. In the future, the Lord will give the Edoms of the world to the animals. When you consider that by the end of the trumpet judgments in the day of the Lord, at least one-third and possibly one-half of the world's population will be dead, and then after that there are still the bowl judgments to come, it seems that a great portion of the currently populated world will become habitations for animals. For a title for this chapter 34, I wrote, "Universal Judgments in the Day of the Lord." just as it was a relief to turn from chapter 24 to chapter 25, it is a similar relief to turn from chapter 34 to chapter 35. After the judgment described in the last chapter, the devastation of the world will be replaced with the glory of redeemed creation. Verses 1 and 2 say, "The wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Araba will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy." According to Easton's Bible Dictionary, the Araba, quote, "denotes the hollow depression through which the Jordan River flows from the Lake of Galilee to the Dead Sea." Later in verse 2, we have a contrast with chapter 33, verse 9. That verse described the destruction of the most fruitful parts of Israel. It spoke of Lebanon, Sharon, Bashan, and Carmel. Here in chapter 35, three of those four places are named, and they will be completely redeemed. The verse says that they will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Verses 3 and 4 address the faithful in Judah in Isaiah's time, but the words of encouragement would also apply to those enduring the great tribulation in the end times. "Encourage the exhausted, strengthen the feeble. Say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you." The next verses describe complete healing and wholeness of God's people in the millennial kingdom. And there will be the healing and the transformation of the land as well. "For waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the Araba, and the scorched land will become a pool and the thirsty ground springs of water. And in this transformed and renewed land, a highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the Highway of Holiness. The redeemed will walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, with everlasting joy upon their heads. They will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." This last verse of chapter 35 is the climax of the theme of God's sovereignty over the nations, a theme that has run from chapter 13 all the way through chapter 35. "The Lord, Almighty God, Jehovah, Yehovah, in Spanish, Jehovah, can deliver his people from any Assyria and any Babylon. And that is because he is Lord over all the nations, past, present, and future. He not only reacts, but he also plans and directs. His counsel is greater than that of any human. He can be trusted, and he will redeem those who trust in him." Next week, when we turn to chapters 36 through 39, we will see a historical example of just that kind of trust and how it results in the deliverance of the people of God from, in that case, Assyria. Knowing these things, having been taught them by Isaiah, we should strive to be the kind of people described in chapter 33, verse 15. We should be people who walk righteously and speak with sincerity. We should reject unjust gain. We should shake our hands so that they hold no bribe. We should stop our ears from hearing about bloodshed, and that means gossip as well. And we should shut our eyes from looking upon evil. Let us not be like the foolish leaders of Judah, who actually believed the Lord did not see or know what they did in secret. Then, continuing in verse 16 of chapter 33, "We will be among those who dwell on the heights, Our refuge will be the impregnable rock. Our bread will be given to us, and our water will be sure. Our eyes will see the King in his beauty, and our eyes will behold a far distant land. The title I chose for chapter 35 was Promises for the Redeemed After the Day of the Lord. The words of our final hymn were written by Eben E. Rexford in 1901. Sometimes I hear strange music like none e'er heard before, come floating softly earthward as through heaven's open door. It seems like angel voices in strains of joy and love that swell the mighty chorus around the throne above. Now soft and low and restful, it floods my soul with peace, as if God's benediction bade all earth's troubles cease. Then grander than the voices of wind and wave and sea, it fills the dome of heaven with glorious harmony. This music haunts me ever, like something heard in dreams. It seems to catch the cadence of heavenly winds and streams. My heart is filled with rapture to think some day to come I'll sing it with the angels, the song of heaven and home. O sweet celestial music heard from a land afar, the song of heaven and homeland, through doors God leaves ajar. Amen.